Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Anchorage or Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. In researching today's program, I came across a quote, which I think I'm going to ask you to bear with me as I read, from Steven Pinker. He's a cognitive scientist and psychologist at Harvard. When talking, and this comes from an article he wrote for the New Republic in 2014, when talking about what an educated people should be able to do, he says, they should know how to distinguish vetted fact from superstition, rumor, unexamined conventional wisdom. They should know how to reason logically and statistically, avoiding fallacies and biases to which the untutored human mind is vulnerable. They should be able to think causally rather than magically and know what it takes to distinguish causation from correlation and coincidence. They should be acutely aware of human fallibility, most notably their own, and appreciate that people who disagree with them are not stupid or evil. Accordingly, they should appreciate the value of trying to change minds by persuasion rather than by intimidation or demagoguery. I very strongly think our guest today, Dr. John Brush, would agree. He's professor of cardiology at the University of Eastern Virginia School of Medicine, and he's here today to discuss his book, The Science of the Art of Medicine, which was actually written to get doctors thinking a little bit more about their own thinking so that they may make better medical decisions. Dr. Brush, it's a pleasure to have you join us today.
Thanks, Thad. It's a pleasure to be part of this program. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
During the
I love that quote, by the way. That's a terrific quote, and that would have been a great thing to put in the front of my book, because that really describes what I was thinking about when I started writing the book.
There's a lot of very interesting information that's come out in the last several years that I know we're going to get into today that'll, I think, help us all understand his quote a little bit better. But hopefully, one of the reasons why I contacted you about doing this program was not only your book, but because I think there's so much about what's in the book that can help us all be better at thinking. So we're going to try to not only use a lot of medical information here, but and make it make sense to people, but also to make you realize why we all can do some things to make ourselves better at making decisions on a daily basis. And by the way, those of you who are listening, if you've got questions or comments during the next hour, there's a couple of ways you can get a hold of us. Our local number, 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Brush, why don't you just start by telling us a little bit about what induced you to decide to write the book in the first place?
There are a couple of reasons. Number one, I teach medical residents, and I was trying to figure out a way to teach them how to become seasoned physicians, and so I put together a lecture series of things that I thought was important. But the lecture series ends up it was just inadequate. I needed to go into greater depth, and so I thought a book format would be useful. But the other thing that got me thinking about this is I was doing a lot of work with the American College of Cardiology on quality and quality of care. And the American College of Cardiology is very, very focused on improving the quality of care and figuring out how to measure quality and how to assure quality. And it really got me thinking about, well, what is the fundamental problem that can lead to bad decisions and poor quality, and more often than not, it's poor judgment. So, in thinking about poor judgment, I started doing some reading on this and came across the entire field of cognitive psychology, which is a field that has really arisen after I went to college over 30 years ago. It's a relatively new branch of psychology, but cognitive psychology is a branch of psychology that's interested in understanding how people make decisions. Well, doctors make decisions all day long, and so it seems like cognitive psychology would have importance on how doctors make those decisions and should be included in medical education. But in fact, it's not. There's very little about medical about decision making and the science of decision making, actually, in medical school and medical training. So I thought that was a deficiency, and so I actually read about the topic for about 5 years, and I kept telling my wife, I said, you know what, I could write a book on this. And after saying that a couple of times, I actually started writing a book on this and ended up publishing a book recently that you mentioned. So it was an interest in quality and improving quality of care. It was also an interest in teaching and doing a better job of teaching. And those combined interests made me decide to sit down and write the book.
The title, The Science of the Art of Medicine, means a lot to me. Perhaps you can explain what you are meaning by and the importance of that title to our listeners.
So people think that, a lot of medicine is an art, and, particularly making a diagnosis. People, if you ask doctors how they make a diagnosis, they may not be able to explicitly explain it to someone. They say, oh, it just appeared to me. It just came, I just stumbled on the diagnosis or whatever. But actually, there's more to it than that. There's the science of cognitive psychology, which helps us understand things like heuristics, which are mental processes that help us make rapid decisions under conditions of uncertainty. There's logic that helps us deal with uncertainty and go from what we know to something that we don't know. There's probability that helps us understand the chances of things and the likelihood of things that are uncertain. And so there actually is a science behind some of that art that we talk about. And it happens almost intuitively amongst experienced physicians, but ends up, you can't wait until someone becomes an experienced physician 30 years into it. What you want is for trainees to come out of their training program and to be good at this, from day one. And so I tried to really think about, well, what is the science of decision-making as it relates to medical decision-making? And what are the important and salient parts of the science of what we call the art of medicine? So I really tried to examine it, break it down, and really examine it. There's a engineer who was very interested in quality. It's W. Edwards Deming. He said, if you can't describe what you're doing as a process, you don't know what you're doing. So what I tried to do is I tried to understand the art of medicine as a process. I tried to break it down in its component parts to try to understand what we were doing. It was much of a education for me and a personal journey for me to write the book as it was, just the process of writing. So, I really learned a lot in the process of writing the book and it was a real journey for me. It was a lot of fun actually doing the background reading for the book.
So my training was back in the 70s. I'm a little bit gotcha by some years. And then I went and was an epidemiologist for a couple of years. And to me, that's where I got inculcated with the idea of thinking more rationally and so forth. And yet I've really been even brought along even further by my reading like you have on cognitive science and so forth. So what's the evidence now in your mind that we still need to improve the thinking skills, decision-making skills of physicians in training today?
Well, I think there's evidence that that we fall short frequently on making diagnoses, and we probably do that because we don't proceed logically. We don't. We jump to conclusions, and we don't use what we call a differential diagnosis, where we ask, you know, what else could it be? There's a tendency to jump to conclusions. I think there's a tendency to jump towards things that are, you know, kind of new technology. And maybe jump on the bandwagon of new technology, whereas maybe some technologies haven't necessarily been of proven benefit. So, I think that's a problem. I think we're asked to do more and more. And one of the things we're asked to do is something called shared decision making, where we're supposed to sit down with patients and help patients understand something about the decisions and help guide them through it, but also do it in a way that gets their input. Well, I mean, I think that makes it much, much more important to understand the process of our own decision making so that we can help guide patients through that process. I think there have been a number of reports from the Institute of Medicine that have talked about sort of breakdowns in medicine. There's the crossing the quality chasm and to err as human. And just about 2 months ago, there was an Institute of Medicine report on diagnostic error that was published that has brought public attention to the fact that we could do better. There's room for improvement. And so... And my own personal belief is that there's room for improvement in the way we think about how we think, and if we think about that a little bit harder and are educated a little bit better at thinking about how we think, then we can avoid some of the pitfalls, the common pitfalls that cognitive psychologists tell us that not only doctors but all human beings fall into.
Let me take just a second to remind listeners, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. John Brush. We're talking about his book, The Science of the Art of Medicine, and it's really about how we can go about improving, making particularly better medical decisions. But I think there's information that we all can take away from our discussion today. So that's kind of the subplot about why we're talking today about Dr. Brush's book. If you've got questions or comments, please don't hesitate to call. Our local number again, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. I've been in practice now over 30 years, and one of the things I've noticed is that nurse practitioners, physicians that are coming out of training, often are very, very good at a lot of problems that I don't address every day. So our frame of reference coming out of training is very different. And I kind of see physicians thinking about, the very unusual rather than the thing we see every day. My problem is remembering that there sometimes these unusual things do happen. I see their problem is thinking about it too soon, too quickly, when it's much more likely to be something that's much more common. And that's part of the logic and probability you're talking about. And again, it also demonstrates some of our bias from our frame of reference and where we're coming from.
Yeah, there are two types of medical knowledge. There's content knowledge and there's experiential knowledge. And so doctors just out of training, they are just packed full of content knowledge. They have to learn a lot of facts to pass their boards and to get through school and what have you. And they're very good at regurgitating those facts and recalling those facts. Whereas physicians that are in practice for a longer period of time, I think they have a way of putting those facts into proper perspective and context. They've got the broad perspective and they have an intuitive sense of probability. They make better bets because they've been at it for a long time. So that's called experiential knowledge. One of my goals was to try to figure out, some of the components of experiential knowledge so that you could teach them to trainees. So how do you quantify some of this so that you can make it a little bit easier to understand for early trainees or early practice physicians so that they can get up to speed with the experiential knowledge faster? For us, who've been in practice for a while, we still have to go back and practice our boards and become recertified, so we have to review the content knowledge from time to time. And so we have to stay up on that as well. But the goal of the book is to be able to bring early trainees and students and residents up to speed quicker on what would be considered experiential knowledge.
This brings me to one of the questions I think that others who are listening might wonder as well, and that's the idea of intuition. What is intuition? Where does it fall into this framework of logic, probability, cognitive psychology that you're discussing?
Yeah, intuition. You know, physicians have to use intuition a lot. And the reason why we have to use intuition is because there's a lot that's not known about what we're dealing with. You know, there's infinitely, you know, the human body is incredibly complex, and there's infinitely more unknown about the human body and disease and biology and what have you than what is known. And so because we have to deal with so much unknown, we have to use intuition. Intuition is not just winging it. It's not guessing. Intuition is a human capability, and I think it's a very important human capability that I guess evolved in human beings for a purpose because it's useful. I would define intuition as the ability to hold an idea in your head. So what we develop as we develop experience, whether it's with in medicine, or whether you're becoming a master chess player, or whether you're becoming an expert art appraiser, or whatever your field is, you develop something called expert intuition, and that's a combination of this formal knowledge and experiential knowledge. And so I think what expert intuition allows you to do, it allows you to hold a more complicated idea in your head. So what it enables is it enables creativity and improvisation and thinking and action and extrapolating and interpolating and all those things that we have to do to kind of fill in the gaps of knowledge so that we can make rapid decisions under conditions of uncertainty in a timely fashion so that we can take care of patients. But I think intuition is something that is an incredibly important part of practicing medicine. It's not something that you can teach, but it's something that you can, I think, lead people to think about more and think about honing a bit. One thing that's very important for intuition is measurement and feedback and getting constant feedback about how you, about your performance, because you can calibrate your intuition through feedback. The other thing that I think you can do is you can calibrate your intuition through continuing education, and there are particular ways that you can calibrate your intuition in medicine. I talked about some. There is some in the book. They're kind of technical about using likelihood ratios and something called numbers needed to treat and what have you. These are numbers that basically simplify a lot of information, but by simplifying that information into a simple number, it enables it to be used to calibrate the intuition.
I guess what I heard you say is the intuition is a combination of this just book learning, so to speak, and our experience. And when you have both of those, your ability to make good intuitive judgments is improved, but it also requires continual sharpening and re-upping that knowledge to be the best that you can be at expert intuition.
That's right. I think that feedback on performance is very important for developing intuition. In medicine, if you make a mistake, it's very important to examine it. Examine what led you to make that mistake. Where did you go wrong? What assumptions did you make? Did you jump to a conclusion? Did you not think of everything? Did you collect all the information that was necessary? Did you follow a systematic order of trying to work through the problem? Did you order all the appropriate tests? Could you have done something sooner? Could you have asked for a consultant to see the patient? You know, all of those questions can come up, when you fall short. And so by asking yourself all those questions and having that type of feedback and reflection, it enables the intuition to improve and become sharper.
Perhaps this is a time that it would be nice to bring in some of the information from cognitive psychology. I do want to maybe use the same line of questioning to get to probability when I ask why do we err in decisions. But I want to bring in Daniel Kahneman and people like him who have used this metaphor of system one thinking and system two thinking to help us understand how we go about thinking about problems and so forth. Can you give us a brief overview of what that bit of information is helpful for us to, why that's important for us to understand?
Sure. Daniel Kahneman is a cognitive psychologist at Princeton University, and he and another person, Dr. Tversky, over the past 30 years have been doing an enormous amount of research related to intuition and one of the things that we use with intuition is something called heuristics. Heuristics are mental processes, as I mentioned before. They're mental processes that allow us to make rapid decisions under conditions of uncertainty. So that's good, but it can also be bad because our heuristics can be biased. So one of the things that Daniel Kahneman and Tversky did over the years is they evaluated our ability to use heuristics, rapid thinking mechanisms, and the biases that those rapid thinking mechanisms can cause. So Daniel Kahneman wrote a book called Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. And the Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow is referring to what you mentioned, the System 1 and System 2 thinking. Other cognitive psychologists have come up with this way of sort of thinking that in our own thinking individually and also collectively, we have sort of different modes of thinking. One is a system one is an intuitive mode, and system two is a very analytical mode. System one is very fast, it's automatic, it's intuitive. System two is slow, it's deliberate, it's analytical. System one is like driving a car down the road. It's almost effortless. You arrive, you know where you're supposed to be, and you don't even think about it. Systems two is like parking your car in a tight space. You're looking and moving very slowly and carefully. So system one loves association. It loves stories. Systems two loves explicit beliefs and reasoned choices. System one sees the forest. System two sees the trees. So you would think systems two would be the ideal mode for making medical decisions, but ends up system two thinking is too slow. So it's too slow for responding to emergencies, but also system two can't handle uncertainty. So the system one intuitive mode, it can make the associations that are necessary to fill in the blanks and to interpolate and extrapolate those things that are necessary to make medical decisions. So ends up you have to use both system one and system two. And I'll give you an example. When a patient comes into the emergency room complaining of, say, a nonspecific subjective complaint, like shortness of breath, that person will throw all kinds of information at you initially, and it's up to you to take that unstructured problem and turn it into a structured problem. And we do that intuitively. We use heuristics to take the cues that the patient is throwing at us, their symptom, their physical exam findings, some lab findings, and put it all together and start to put it together and to make turn it into a structured decision. So we need that system one thinking at first to intuitively start to sort the information that's coming in and pull information together and make associations. But then we kind of turn it over to a more analytical mode, the system two mode, to start to work systematically through the problem. So we might start to choose tests that we might order, and then we take the results of those tests and incorporate them into our thinking, something called iterative hypothesis testing. And that's really sort of turning things over to system two. So In medicine, we really have to make use of both System 1 and System 2 thinking to help our patients.
Is there a non-medical example that comes into your mind? I know in Kahneman's book there's a number of them. I just thought I might ask if you can think of one where we jump to conclusions that are not. He has a classic one about the cost of a bat and ball, but I'll see if you have any off the top of your head that you could suggest.
Yeah, so I think the example of that one is where he fooled System 1 thinking by asking a bat and a ball cost $1.10. How much is bat and the I'm not going to get it correct for you off the top of my head, but you can fool System 1 thinking by the way you frame a question.
Right.
And you can set up System 1 thinking to get the right answer by framing the question more intuitively. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times, System 1 sees what it sees and sees only what it sees. It's not meant to go out and ask questions and analyze questions. That's not what it does. It's meant to jump to conclusions. It's fast. Right. And it's automatic. It's intuitive,
right.
And so it can fall into traps. Okay, it can. You can jump to conclusions if you're, you're trying to be work too fast through a problem. So So there are any number of ways that you can where it can hurt you, but also there are many number of ways and many number of examples where it can help you. One example where System 1 intuitive mode can help people is the example of the experienced firefighter who is in a burning building and then just looks around and just has this intuitive sense that he has to get out of there very quickly because the floor is about to collapse. He can't explain it. It's just something about it, and so he gets his crew out of the building just before the building collapses. Another example is the pediatric ICU nurse who looks at the baby and just says, there's something that doesn't look right about this baby. I need to call the doctor in to take a look at this because I think this baby is septic, for example. And there's just something that's intuitive about that because of experience, that pediatric ICU nurse has that intuitive look. So so oftentimes that System 1 is very, very helpful, but also oftentimes it can lead us to make rash decisions and incorrect decisions. And it can be biased. It can be biased by how we frame things. It can be biased by stereotyping and there are a number of different ways that the System 1 can be fooled.
I remember one of the examples that was very pertinent to me is that whether purposefully or not, somebody who's trying to sell you a house may likely introduce you to a house that costs more than you would like, because as you start with that, you're framed with that, you're more likely to end up buying a house that's much more expensive than you intended to from the get-go. That's that System 1 making decisions based on the framing. Or another one was, he gave an example, if I told you Mahatma Gandhi was more or less than 96 when he died, you would guess a certain age. If I told you he was more or less than 46 when he died, you're going to guess inevitably a lower age, none of the information there really has anything to do with trying to help you understand how old he was. So this kind of framing that you talked about has us making these very quick System 1 decisions that may lead us into trouble sometimes.
Yeah, and so in medicine we have to be very careful about that, because we could make a biased decision based on how things are framed up and end up being the wrong decision. What we're trying to do in medicine is we're trying to apply science to the care of patients, and there is a science out there our decision should be, to the extent possible, framed in the science of medicine. Science both from experimentation and from observation that's written in the literature that we learn about in textbooks and medical journals. That's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to frame our decisions in science and not in sort of whim or belief or bias or stereotyping. So we need to be very careful about that and be aware of the ways that we can bias our judgments. You know, some people are very risk averse, for example. And they may avoid a risky operation, even though in the long run that operation is going to be better for them in the long run.
Right.
For example, doing a bypass operation for somebody who has a narrowing of their left main coronary artery. That's known to help people live longer over the long run, but obviously there's a very big upfront operation that has some risk. And so and by following the science in medicine, you know, one of the things we have to do is kind of do something that's a little bit counterintuitive in that we take some upfront risk for a long-term gain. There's defensive medicine, where we tend to over-order and over-test and over-call things because we're afraid of being sued. And that's a way that we can prime our decisions in medicine. And that I think, is harmful, because you can end up doing things to people that, could lead to actually worse outcomes, because we're trying to overdo everything than do what's really indicated.
Dr. Brush, we are about halfway through, a little bit more than halfway through, and we need to take our normal one-minute break. I'll ask you to just hold on the line. Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number, again, 550-8433, toll-free 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break and continue our discussion of the book, The Science of the Art of Medicine, by Dr. John Brush. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection, from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. And I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. And joining us today from his office in Virginia is Dr. John Brush. He is a professor of cardiology at the East Virginia School of Medicine. And he's written a book called The Science of the Art of Medicine, designed to help physicians in training to learn how to make better medical decisions. I've asked him to be a guest today to talk about the book, but also to hope that we can all glean some information to help us make better decisions and realize why we make mistakes in making decisions. If you have any questions, you can email us. We'll be here for the next 25 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call locally at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And remember, between 8 and 9 on Monday evening, if that's when you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. I also want to make sure you are aware you can go to Alaska Public Media and look up the Line 1 link, and you'll see links to how you might obtain Dr. Brush's book, how you can see a presentation that he made on the book at Stanford School of Medicine, his Grand Rounds presentation, and also some other books on making decisions in cognitive psychology, including Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow, and a couple of others that I've found very, very helpful. A great website for examples of medical rational thinking about problems that you may be aware of every day is sciencebasedmedicine.org as well. All those are links on the Line 1 website. So, Dr. Brush, there are, I think it's usually written, or you wrote in your book as well, there's several ways we err or make mistakes when we try to make decisions or judgments. One, we've kind of talked about, we jump to conclusions using that system one thinking, not slowing down, thinking rationally, trying to get a little bit more evidence, and we always can't take that time. But another reason is we, as humans, have not evolved a particularly good way to think about probability. And so that gets us into trouble sometimes and helps and makes us make poor decisions and poor judgments. You want to talk about probability a little bit?
Probability is actually a really interesting thing to think about and sort of get your head around. You know, probability is uncertainty quantified. It's the ability to put a number on things that are uncertain. It's the likelihood of future events, for example, or it's the likelihood, the chances of some statement becoming true, or the chances of some event happening in the future. And so, you know, when we're dealing with diagnoses in medicine, you know, what is the probability that the person actually does have that diagnosis? Or when we're dealing with, you know, trying to predict events, you know, what is the probability that someone might have a heart attack in the future, and can we affect that probability by placing them on medicines? So we deal with probability all a great deal. But ends up, probability is something that that we don't go into a lot of detail, in medical school. We just assume that people will come through their medical training with some, you know, intuitive sense of probability. Probability is kind of interesting. You know, we talk about logic and you know, the logical thinking. You know, the people have been thinking about logic since Aristotle's time, you know, 250 BC. But probability, really, a numerical concept of probability wasn't thought about until the late 1600s when a guy named Blaise Pascal started to think about how we can put a number on the chances of a future event. So ends up, when you look at events or things that might happen in the future, or how data stacks up, it ends up, it sort of stacks up in the middle and sort of scatters to the edges. And so you end up getting this probability density curve, which looks like a bell-shaped curve. So you can start to understand, what probability actually looks like by sort of visualizing probability. And if you're dealing with discrete probabilities, you can sort of figure out how those possibilities might sort of distribute themselves by creating a probability distribution. And if discrete probabilities are all, if they're mutually exclusive but they're collectively exhausted, then the probabilities of all the possibilities has to all add up to one. So you can start to make calculations about probabilities. Probability can be understood by simple probability, compound probability, cumulative probability, complementary probability, and something called conditional probability. Conditional probability is the probability that something will happen on the condition that something else happens. For example, what is the probability that somebody has coronary artery disease given that they have an abnormal stress test? Well, that's a conditional probability. We use that kind of conditional probability all the time in medicine. And the probability, the conditional probability depends upon really two things. It depends upon, well, what's the probability that somebody has coronary disease in the first place? You know, if it's a 10-year-old child, it's probably zero. If it's a 70-year-old man, it's maybe 80%. So that affects the probability, but then also it depends upon the strength of the new information that you add to the calculation. And so it depends upon two things. It depends upon your baseline probability, and it depends upon the strength of new information. So having an understanding of conditional probability is extremely important for understanding medicine. People have these two notions of probability. And philosophers and mathematicians and statisticians argue about this a great deal, but there is this frequency notion of probability where it's a hard measurement of things that have happened in the past. and it's measured with an average or a mean and a dispersion around that mean, which is the standard deviation. So that's a frequency notion of probability, and people argue that that's the only way that you can think about probability. But there's another way of thinking about probability. It's the personal notion of probability or a subjective notion of probability, where probability is really an estimate of your conviction or your degree of belief that something is going to happen or something is true. And then you've got some degree of ambiguity around that degree of belief. So it's what do you think and are you sure? So we have to really use both notions of probability in medicine. We come up with some notion of the probability of something based on past research that has given us an idea of how often something, some event or some diagnosis occurs in a population of people. But then what we have to do is we have to apply that to an individual patient. We see patients one at a time, and so then you have to shift to this personal notion of probability where you try to think, well, what's the probability, what is my degree of conviction or degree of belief about an individual patient? So I can give you an example. We oftentimes talk to patients about the risks of a surgical procedure and the risk of making it through a surgical procedure. And so we'll say that, you know, your chances of making it through a bypass operation is 95%, for example. Well, if a patient's really thinking, they'll look at you and say, well, what do you mean by that, doctor? You know, with me, it's either 0 or 100%. And so you got that measurement of 95% based on a past measurement, a frequency notion of probability, based on a study that may have been done or your own aggregated experience in taking care of patients. And so you came up with that measurement, you know, 95 out of 100 patients will make it through the operation. But what you're really saying to the patient is you're 95% sure you're going to get them through the operation. So you have to shift to that personal notion of probability when you're taking care of patients one at a time. So it's really important to sort of think about it a bit. We use the notion of probability all the time when we're trying to take care of patients. We're basically making bets all day long because we're dealing with uncertain situations. We're unsure of the true state of the patient. Patients come with complaints and subjective complaints, and we're trying to figure out what's going on deep down inside of them. And so we're trying to figure out make some kind of a probability assessment. But then we start assigning tests, we start doing tests, but those tests aren't perfect. Those tests are imperfect tests, and so we have to decide whether that test is absolutely definitive or whether it's just suggestive, and how much is that going to change your initial notion about the patient.
There's a couple of examples and good descriptions of all of this in your book, and I know one thing that it comes to my mind commonly is this idea that, let's say we have a very accurate test. It's 95, 96, 97% accurate, but we're looking for a very rare or a very unusual problem, let's say, that only happens in one in several hundred thousand people. I think it's important for people to understand that test then, which is very accurate when looking for these disorders, is going to be wrong, falsely positive, more often than it's right. And it gets down to doing some paperwork, but it's maybe you can help us understand why that might be true very easily. It's a common problem I seem to run into with patients.
Yeah, so people, patients oftentimes want to have screening tests performed. And, you know, it seems like a really good idea to screen for cancer so that you can catch it really early and, you know, treat it really early and maybe have a better chance of winning the battle against cancer if you catch it early and treat it early. So that, you know, even so that brings up this notion of screening for cancer before you have any kind of symptom or sign that you have any kind of cancer. So mammography is a very good test. It's a very accurate test. But if you're using it in a population of women who has a very, very low likelihood, you know, young women who have no, family history or whatever, then it becomes a poor test because you're more likely to turn up false positives than true positives. And so a false positive, it creates a lot of alarm and panic, and it leads to a surgical procedure, a biopsy, and which has pain and discomfort and risk and what have you. And so screening in a young population with a very low pretest probability doesn't make sense. PSA testing is another example in men. PSA testing is looking for prostate cancer. So again, it's a reasonably good test. You know, it tells us, you know, whether it gives you a number, and based on that number, you can make some prediction as to whether there is prostate cancer present. But if you do it on young men, you know, you're going to get a false positive more than you're going to get a true positive. In fact, for PSA testing, it seems to be across the board. It just doesn't seem to be that helpful in alerting us to cancer sooner in a way that helps us, you know, win the battle against cancer. What it does is it creates all these little side skirmishes and all kinds of collateral damage because it doesn't really do the job. HIV screening is another example. HIV AIDS is a pretty serious disease, and when it was first discovered and people wanted to sort of get a handle on the epidemic, people were saying, well, everybody should be tested for HIV/AIDS. Well, that would have created all kinds of problems, you know, mass screening for HIV/AIDS, even though the tests are pretty good, would have created all kinds of false positives, a lot of panic, a lot of unnecessary, I think, harmful worry among patients because, you know, while they're working through it and finding out using other testing mechanisms that they, in fact, don't have the disease, they spend that time very, very worried about things. And so understanding this conditional probability and the understanding that that the probability of something depends not only on the test result, but it depends upon what their pretest probability is in the first place. Let me give you another example. Let's say you had had a test that was meant to evaluate animals, and this test showed you that pigs fly. Well, you would immediately reject the result of the test because you know intuitively that pigs don't fly. Well, that's kind of what we're doing with screening sometimes. You know, when you're screening with people who have a very, very low pretest probability of having a disease and you're doing a test and you get back a positive test, it's sort of like saying, well, pigs fly. But if you know something about the probabilities and the pretest probability, your reaction should be, well, no, pigs don't fly.
All right. I would take that analogy even further in saying that there may be, even though the likelihood that pigs fly is pretty low, there may be some evidence, there may be somebody who says, well, I saw a pig fly. You know I saw the pig fly. And then you get into this issue. So even though there's very good evidence, what you really should be asking is how good is that evidence if the prior probability is so unlikely, so that very unlikely things require even better evidence. It may turn out that the person who said he saw the pig fly actually misunderstood what they were seeing, but believed to their dying day that was a pig that was flying. So this prior probability becomes very, very important, even in the face of some evidence sometimes.
Right. So extraordinary claims require extraordinarily strong evidence. And so every once in a while, you have overwhelming evidence that's going to, you know, change your pre-existing notion of something. And you always have to keep an open mind as well. I don't think that it's a good idea to become so locked into your pretest probability or your preconceived notion that you don't change based on new evidence. What we use in medicine and in life in general to estimate conditional probability is we actually use a heuristic, and the heuristic is called anchoring and adjusting. So when we decide, what's the probability of something, We usually start off with some anchor, some initial estimate of the probability, and then we adjust that initial estimate based on some new piece of information. And so that's what we do in medicine. We don't actually make the calculations of the conditional probabilities. Usually we do it intuitively using the anchoring and adjusting heuristic. And there are two ways that you can go wrong. One is to become so anchored in your pretest probability that you don't adequately adjust. But the other way is to just take the piece of information at face value without considering the pretest probability, and that's a fallacy called base rate neglect. So you can get it wrong either way, and the important thing is to understand what you're doing and try to think about what you're doing just a little bit so that you can you can hit the right mark and you can make the best estimates you can make and try to sort through a problem.
John, we have a caller. I want to take her call. Carolyn, you're on line one.
Yeah, this is Caroline. Thank you. General question and then specific to the medical. People are very polarized in our thinking, and someone has referred to that as tribalism. And I wondered if in the last 100 years we have moved away from living close to relatives, and if the concept of thinking the same as a whole bunch of other people gives us a sense of belonging. And then the specific to medical is, what has been the difference in all of these ads that are pitched to the patients directly, and we're told to go ask our doctor about such and such,
right,
if we think we have such and such?
Right. Couple of good points there. John, did you get that?
Yeah. So first of all, on this polarized, I guess maybe you're talking about, politics and maybe view on science, view on global warming, all kinds of things. It seems that, we are very polarized these days. That brings up something that's called confirmation bias. When you start with your preset notion of something, then you start going out and you look for facts that conform to your preset notion. And so that's not a very good way to sort of follow your way to the truth of something. That's the way to, basically justify or support your preconceived notion. And I think that's what you see. You see, people will tune into their own cable news network that happens to have their own point of view. And what you see is people basically coming up with the facts that conform to their own point of view. So I think that that's a big problem, and that's a cognitive psychology problem. That's not very good reasoning, and I think we need to get beyond that and try to seek out the truth and take ourselves where the truth will lead us. That's what science is supposed to be about. So you brought up the fact about not only fads, but direct-to-consumer advertising of drugs. I think that patients and the public in some ways is vulnerable because they're not fully informed, and they can be but they're very concerned about their own health, and they can have a sort of a disproportionate amount of concern because of dread either dread or wishful thinking, or there are all kinds of biases that come into play when someone is trying to take care of themselves. Whereas if you're working with a physician who's sort of looking at things objectively, you can kind of avoid that. And so what I think a lot of the direct consumer advertising does is it says, you may have, dry eyes or restless legs or something like that. Well, you didn't even know you had it, but all of a sudden you're going to your doctor asking for a very expensive medicine to try to take care for to that particular problem. There are a lot of medicines out there that are of totally unproven benefit that are being pushed. A lot of the vitamins and health foods and what have you that just aren't of any proven benefit. And I think patients are quite vulnerable to kind of being sold a bill of goods on that. And one of the things that doctors are supposed to do is they're supposed to pay attention to the science and the evidence. And oftentimes what we pay attention to are something called randomized controlled trials, where you try to eliminate the bias by randomizing, by basically flipping a coin, by putting people into two different groups, a group that gets a a drug that you're trying to test versus a drug that is basically a placebo, a sugar pill, and to try to measure objectively whether something actually has an effect. So, you know, most of the medicines that we use in using something called evidence-based medicine are exposed to that type of testing, randomized controlled trials, whereas many of the things that are pushed onto the public through direct consumer advertising have not been, you know, exposed to that kind of vigorous scientific evaluation. Very good questions. Thank you, Carolyn.
Well, hello?
Yep.
Yeah, I was thinking specifically in terms of the attitude people had between about vaccinations and how that kind of fever swept through. And I was also asking about the impact of this direct advertising on how people interface with their doctor. Mm-hmm. If there is more hostility and if the polarized thinking has extended to how people interact with their doctor.
Let me, John, before you answer, we got about 2 minutes. I just want to keep everybody on task here.
So the vaccination thing, particularly the measles vaccination thing, I think is a really sad thing. You know, measles vaccination, I guess it was thought to, you know, there was a study that has been discredited, but that had some association with autism. And but that has been discredited. It's totally false. And so there are situations where people decide that, you know, vaccination is not what they want, and so you get these pockets of measles that spread in California last year and Pennsylvania several years ago and what have you. With vaccination, there's something called herd immunity that's very important, that, you know, you have to have a lot of people vaccinated so that because there are people in the community that can't get a vaccine because of a variety of reasons. And if without herd immunity, those people will be quite vulnerable. So I think that's one where, you know, you got to rely on science and you've got to rely on scientific experts at times, you know, to really lead you towards what's really the right thing to do. The CDC and places like that, they are really on track. They provide good evidence. You know, for things like Ebola and measles vaccine and what have you, they're, I think, a very reliable source of information.
So often we kind of start with the idea, we've got an idea, and we look for information, as you said earlier, that supports it rather than try to find where the evidence leads. I've heard this defined or described much more succinctly. It says, do you really want to know what is right, or do you try to do you really want to be right, or do you want to understand what is right? And that gets to just keeping an open mind and looking at the quality of the evidence for all of this information we've talked about today.
It's important to understand that there's a scientific method, and scientific method is based on careful observation or experimentation, and it's very important to follow that method. And one of the things about medicine in 2016 is that it's supposed to be evidence-based. It's supposed to be science-based. If we're not using evidence-based or science-based medicine, you know, we're snake oil salesmen. We're frauds. And so one of the things that we need to do to make sure that we are professionals is to adhere to science and pay attention to science. And so that's part of what my book is about, is how do you apply the science to individual patients at the bedside.
John, thanks very much for taking the time. My thanks to our guest, cardiologist Dr. John Brush, and his book, The Science and the Art of Medicine. We'll return next week. We're not entirely clear what the topic's going to be or a guest, as we're jockeying with a few potential guests, but please sure and join us next Monday at 2 p.m. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.